Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect introduces Jonathan DeMarino, the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor of Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, address a room full of journalists about medical ethics.
What I'll do is I'll tell you a little bit more about what I do. I'll try to, because Rick Weiss is now my colleague at Center for American Progress, he gave me some ideas about some things that you might need to know about as journalists when you report on issues involving or topics involving medical ethics and you call somebody in medical ethics. I'll talk a little bit about what's going on with stem cell issue, sort of politically, and which I'm very involved in. So the topics that I spend most of my time working on are, besides the stem cell issue, I co-chair the National Academy's committee that wrote guidelines 3 years ago for doing human embryonic stem cell research, because the Bush administration has not issued much guidance on that. The National Academy stepped in. I wrote a book that Carol kindly mentioned called Mind Wars a couple of years ago. I published on the use of neuroscience in national security. In August, I was on a National Research Council committee that published a report on brain research and national intelligence, kind of creepy stuff like that I like. 8 years ago, I published a book called Undue Risk about the subtitle of which was Secret State Experiments on Humans. That's a history of history and ethics of from sort of World War II on doing experiments involving human beings for national security purposes. So I really like that creepy stuff, actually, especially. I also, as Carol mentioned, I've gotten involved in sort of developing a venue online called Science Progress through the Center for American Progress, which, do you know what that is, Center for American Progress? So CAP is now the largest sort of center-left think tank in Washington. It was founded by John Podesta 4.5 years ago, by my count, 4 of Obama's senior advisors have come from CAP, and a number of more junior people. So that'll give you some idea of my prejudices. So I am a philosopher by training. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a historian. Not a doctor. Not a medical doctor. I got interested in bioethics in the late 70s when I took a job at George Washington University here in town. And as an assistant professor, I was saying to a couple of people before, when you're asked to do something, you say yes, right? Because you want to make it as hard as possible for them not to give you tenure. And I had known Art Kaplan, actually, at Penn, my friend and colleague at Penn, since we were in New York in graduate school at the same time in the 70s, and I had kind of followed what Art was up to. And I was very intrigued by the fact that there was an opportunity for philosophers to say something about something that was happening in the real world. So I gradually got more and more hooked, and my entry into bioethics or medical ethics was pretty much standard at the time. Most people who kind of cut their teeth in bioethics, until fairly recently anyway, started out by doing hospital ethics, clinical ethics, bedside ethics, ethics committees, ethics consultation, and writing about hospital ethics sorts of issues. More and more people have gotten into doing policy work and the kind of thing that I'm doing now, and I'll sort of come back to that. But it might be useful for you as journalists to know a little. I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of the history of bioethics. It really is generally thought to have started in the late 60s through American chauvinism, generally in the U.S. In 1969, a philosopher named Dan Callahan, who worked at the Population Council at that time and was an associate editor at Commonweal, had a dinner party in Hastings-on-Hudson, and he invited some neighbors, and he and his neighbor, a psychiatrist named Will Galen, started talking about what they were into. And they were both very interested in the fact that there were these amazing things happening in medicine and science that were clearly going to have a big impact on society. So, you know, the late 60s was the time when people were starting to talk about organ transplants, the first ones in South Africa, you know, heart transplants, advanced cardiac life support, keeping people alive for longer periods of time, but sort of a half-life kind of situation. In 53, Watson and Crick, the geneticists, solved the human genome, and they their interest in what was genetics going to do to society, how is that going to change, is that a Brave New World sort of phenomenon. And they said, you know, what we ought to do is we ought to try to get some grants to start a little institute of some kind, and that was the beginning of the Hastings Center, which is the oldest bioethics think tank, still exists, and I worked for the Hastings Center for a while, as did a number of other people who've gotten into bioethics. So the early issues in the Hastings Center were the ones that I mentioned, organ transplants, artificial hearts in particular, keeping people alive without returning the previous quality of life, and the genetics issues. Also, the other issues that came along pretty fast had to do with doing human experiments, doing controlled clinical trials involved a lot of ethical concerns, so that also got on people's plates. In the mid-70s, after the center was really going, there was the Karen Ann Quinlan case, which you know about, which really put a focus not only on the ethics of taking care of people who were in persistent vegetative states, but also the legal issues, who decides, obviously takes us up to Schiavo, which I could talk about if you like. By the late 70s, the first National Commission on Human Research Ethics was established, and government commissions have had a more important role in bioethics than any other academic field. They actually created a kind of legitimacy for bioethicists to say things about public policy. In the 80s, things just started. I remember walking down the street with Art Kaplan, matter of fact, in 1980 in Manhattan, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to keep doing this stuff, but what's the future, do you think? Do you think this field of bioethics has a future? And he said, I'm not so sure. I think I might have peaked. So that was 1980. So many things happened in the 80s. It's hard for me to keep track of, but two things I'll just mention. One was controversies about the care of severely impaired newborns in the neonatal intensive care unit. That was a big issue in the mid-80s. And then in the late 80s, HIV/AIDS. My first full-time medical school job was at Downstate Medical School in Brooklyn. There were two primary indications for admission to Kings County Hospital across the street in Brooklyn. One was diabetes-related complications, the other was HIV/AIDS. It was almost impossible to get a bed at Kings County unless you had sort of one of those two kinds of problems. And HIV just dominated my life for 8 years, and there are lots, obviously, incredible ethical issues involved with HIV, and that many people in bioethics were doing that at that time. That stimulated interest in a field called public health ethics, and that area also has grown. And then I think a big transition happened, and I should say, while all this is going on, there continue to be several presidential bioethics commissions, which continued to, which I can talk more about, which again gave a kind of legitimacy to bioethics that that it wouldn't have had otherwise. During this time, there was kind of a shift in the kind of folks who went into bioethics, who dominated the field. In the beginning, I would say the theologians were very important. And for example, the second bioethics institute in the country was at Georgetown. The Kennedy family was very interested in ethical issues in mental retardation because, as you know, one of JFK's sisters was retarded. Her Joe Kennedy authorized a neurosurgery for her that actually made her worse. And so the Kennedy family was interested in ethical issues in mental retardation and in psychosurgery and innovative surgery. So they gave some money to Georgetown to start the Kennedy Institute of Bioethics, which still exists. But in general, theologians, particularly in the 70s, I think, became less important in the field. And with the Quinlan case, in particular, the lawyers became more important. So as my former boss at Hastings Center liked to say, Dan Callahan, what started out as prophetic bioethics, to say what's the long-term future of the human race given these amazing things, gradually transformed into more and more of a regulatory field. So now you as a journalist might call a professor of medical ethics to ask about, you know, what the FDA's rules are for doing human experiments, for example. So So more and more, even the philosophers like me had to learn about the regulatory system and commented on and sat on commissions to change the way that many of these regulations affect the practice of medicine or the or human experiments or the applications of ethical issues in public health. So by the 90s, bioethics was very well established. There were think tanks at many universities, departments of usually centers or programs in medical ethics or bioethics or healthcare ethics, sometimes also called. And there were a number of professorships, endowed chairs in bioethics in medical schools. The American Association of Medical Colleges actually requires that all medical students have some training in medical ethics. The hospital organizations require that to accredit a hospital, you have to have some mechanism, an ethics committee, that will try to resolve ethical issues without going to court or without making people go to risk managers, who are basically lawyers and work for the hospital. Every institution that does research now has to have access to an animal care committee if they do work with animals, or an IRB, right, if they do work with human beings in clinical trials. So bioethics has been institutionalized academically in the legal and policy world, and institutionalized in hospitals and in research facilities. And the strange thing about all this is that this has all happened without anybody being clear who counts as a bioethicist. That is to say, there is no accreditation board as there is in medicine. There's no single credential that makes you a bioethicist. And this causes a problem for journalists, because you may not know what the credentials that somebody, you know, are. When you call them, you might be told by a colleague, oh, this person knows something about this issue, this ethical issue, but it may not be clear what really qualifies them to be an expert commentator. So you know, there are professors of bioethics, and there are people who sit on hospital ethics committees and sit on IRBs. They may be doctors or scientists or lawyers or nurses or social workers or philosophers, but there is no single credential, and I think that creates kind of a unique problem for people who are reporting on these issues. Who do you call? How do you know that they're really authorities? By the late 90s, a new set of issues, and I haven't even, by the way, talked about genetics, and we can talk about that, and IVF and so forth. But by the late 90s, there was an interesting shift, I think, for some of us in bioethics. We had learned about, you know, working in hospitals and doing bedside ethics and doing ethics consultations. We'd learned about research, human research ethics and animal care ethics, and we learned some stuff about public health ethics through HIV/AIDS. In the late 90s, though, it was clear that there were more and more issues coming up in the basic sciences and basic research and laboratory research. And the one issue, of course, that really struck people was when Dolly was cloned in 96. Could you do this could you start to clone human beings? And then in 98, 10 years ago in November, just coming up soon, the first papers were published that showed that you could derive what we call human embryonic stem cells from 5-day-old human embryos. And that has, you know, that has initiated this incredibly weird, long-standing public debate that has gone through now 3 presidential election cycles, although less important in this one than the last two, about the ethics of doing human embryonic stem cells and using embryos in research. So in 1998, when those human ESLs were first derived in a laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin, and also over in Hopkins, very near to each other in time, people started raising questions about the appropriateness of doing research involving embryos. And yet the possibilities of human embryonic stem cell research for medicine were obviously profound. So just to kind of transition now into a little bit of a quick talk about why this has become so important to the science world. It's not well understood. So the thing about human embryonic stem cells is that they're pluripotent. They become all the cells of the body. And you don't have to think about it very long. You think, well, gee, if I have some bad cells, and you could put some of those cells into, like, my heart muscle or my spinal cord or my pancreas to make it work right if I have diabetes, you know, great stuff. If you think about it, there are really only 3 things that doctors can do. They can give you drugs, and all drugs have side effects, though we generally don't learn what they are. They can suggest surgery, And there are very few people who wake up in the morning wanting to have surgery. And that does bad things to you too. Or they can wait. They watchful waiting. And they probably don't do enough of watchful waiting now because there's no money in it, frankly. And we can talk more about the economy of medicine. So wouldn't it be terrific if we could do what reptiles could do? Reptiles, when you cut off one of their limbs, they grow them back. Somehow in evolution, and I do believe in evolution, put my cards on the table, in evolution, we have lost the ability to regrow our limbs. There's only one organ in the human body that regenerates perfectly. Right, the liver. A lot of people think it's skin. Skin doesn't do it perfectly because, first of all, if you lose enough of it, you're screwed. You have to get a graft. And also, even a little bit of it, you know, you get scars. Right? I have cuts that I had when I was a teenager that I still have scars. So it's not perfect. But liver is, nobody knows why that is. It's, you know, it's an accident, it's an evolutionary accident. That's why you can give a hunk of your liver to a friend who needs a liver transplant. It goes back in a few months. But so wouldn't it be terrific if we could regenerate these organs and tissue systems using our own cells? And then you wouldn't have the transplant issues and immunorejection issues and so forth. So that's one reason people are excited about embryonic stem cells or some way of making cells pluripotent that can do these things. Another reason people are excited is you can test drugs against these cells, maybe without using people or animals. So drug development actually is a huge area that people don't talk about enough when they talk about human embryonic stem cells. And the other area is learning about how our genes, we know very little about how our genes express properties in the early embryo. There's embryo research is, you know, is somewhat tainted. It's hard to do. There's not much money in it. But if we could get systems of cells from early embryos that have, we know that come from, say, people that have certain diseases, because probably all of our diseases that we get later in life, the process is happening when we're embryos. So, but we understand very little of that. Now, there's just to give you an example of how interesting this is, a group showed that it's not, think about Down syndrome, trisomy 21. Turns out it's not the extra chromosome itself that is the problem in Down syndrome. This is some recent work that's being done. It turns out that extra chromosome sets off a cascade of chemical reactions in the embryo. And those reactions are, those messages are manifest in children who have the typical symptoms of Down syndrome, the facial symptoms, the cognitive impairment, the cardiac problems, and so forth. So we know from this kind of cellular work, we can begin to figure out what's happening in people at these very early stages. So there are lots of reasons to do work involving these kinds of cells. As you know, in 2001, President Bush said that only human ES cell lines that had been derived before that night, August 9, 2001, could be used in experiments that were paid for by the NIH. And we've been sort of fighting this battle, you know, ever since. The president has twice vetoed the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act, which would have enabled more ES cell lines to be part of research that came from fertility clinics, from leftover embryos with the consent of the progenitors, of the people who had no longer any reproductive use of those embryos. The cultural battle is different from the actual legislative debate. The cultural battle has been about the moral status of the human embryo. Is it a person or does it have rights? And so we can talk more about that. The legislative battle has really just been about whether NIH funding can be used for research involving human embryonic stem cell lines derived after August 9th, 2001. That is the sum and substance of what that legislative debate in Congress has been about. Now, many people think that, and I was just talking to a Post reporter, Sankar Vandrathan, who works for the Post, called me today. His assignment is, I guess this is next week too. His assignment is to write a story about how the country would be different under an Obama or McCain presidency. Small, I think they gave him 2,000 words to do that. So I said, Sankar, do you know? So isn't it your impression that people think that if the current rules were changed, and this is a bit of reportage that somebody needs to do, so I'm going to since you invited me, I'm going to suggest this. Most Americans think that what President Bush wants to make sure of is that no federal funds, no taxpayer funds are used to destroy human embryos, right? I mean, how many of you think, well, I don't want to give myself away here, but most people think that President Bush is right, that the opposition believes this, that President Bush is right, that we should not use federal tax dollars to destroy human embryos, even though good things could happen in medicine if we did that. Well, actually, in fact, the debate has never been about that, because there is a law, and you don't have to believe me, you can Google it, called the Dickey Wicker Amendment that's been applied to the NIH budget since 1996 that says that no federal funds can be used to destroy a human embryo, or in particular, the language is to put a human embryo at risk. So this is not, so the public debate, I think, has totally missed this.
What year was it?
1996. So the public debate has never been about using public money to pay for research that would destroy an embryo or even put it at risk. It's just been about using public monies to do research on the cells derived from those embryos. So where does the, as Shankar said, well, where does the money come from to do the derivation that destroys the embryo? And the answer is, as long as it's not federal, it could be private, it could be state, if the state permits that. So that's just one example. One of Rick's comments to me today was, give him an idea about something that hasn't been reported on that might be a game changer in the way people think about these things. And that, it seems to me, is one with respect to the stem cell debate. It is not about using public money, federal funds, to destroy embryos. So obviously that's an issue that, you know, I feel very passionately about. We can talk about the theological and philosophical issues if you like. Most Americans, when they're surveyed, actually 60-70% favor human embryonic stem cell research. If you ask me, do they understand what they're being surveyed about, I'm not so sure. It's a complicated issue. Obama has basically said that he would issue an executive order that would reverse the Bush policy and open up funding to more stem cell lines. The old lines are of decreasing usefulness in the laboratory. They're also not genetically diverse, and there are a lot of problems with them. McCain has said that he's pro-embryonic stem cell research, probably because he promised Nancy Reagan that he would take that position years ago. But if you follow his statements in the last couple of weeks, and actually Rick Weiss and I published an op-ed in the Boston Globe last week about this, his statements have gotten more and more hedgy as he's become the nominee. The GOP platform, and I guess nobody cares about party platforms anymore, the GOP platform that was adopted a couple of weeks ago actually would criminalize all embryo research, period, end of story. So obviously McCain doesn't agree with the platform, and so the interesting question is, well, what would really happen in a McCain presidency? What kinds of restrictions would there continue to be? And that's sort of something I'm talking to the press a lot about right now. So did I take my 21 minutes? I think I just about got there.
Yeah, you're right.
Unbelievable, yeah. So I'm going to stop there. I've tried to tell you a little bit about sort of what I do, what the history of the field, how it's evolved, the fact that you really have to think in functional terms about who you call and what their expertise is when you decide to get some background on an issue. The stem cell debate, which is the hottest one, but we have not seen the last of. It's going to continue, I think. And it's going to get more complicated because the more, and I'll just give you this tidbit, the more that stem cell biologists know about what to do with cells, the more that they will be able to challenge our concepts of what counts as a potential life. Because some of the work that's going on right now may actually be able to turn all of the cells in your body into a cell of an embryo. Now, I think the most difficult and annoying public health issue right now is the vaccination stuff. And if you get below a certain point, of herd immunity, as you know, then everybody's kids are at risk. That's very frustrating. And yet, say parents are parents, and though they have rights to decide what their kids are exposed to. Right. So the ethics of public health is really interesting stuff.
You've been listening to Jonathan DeMarino, the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor of Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, address a room full of journalists about medical ethics. And now it's time for a break before we go on to our review of the news. This is Dutch Mason, Walking Blues.
Thank you very much, folks. Appreciate it. Don't forget to pick up one of them CDs, eh? Like I told you, we only got 50,000 of them left. Let's do the old walking blues. This morning, people, look back for my shoes. Get ahead, my gate of them. Me no walking blues. Woke up this morning, look round for my shoes. You know, I gotta have my gate of them. Me no walking blues. Some people say now that the blues ain't bad. Lord, the bad woman I ever had. Woke up this morning, looked round for my shoes. You know I gotta have my gate down. Me no walking blues. Tell them, Zeke. Of whiskey, an hour a duck, swim to the bottom, I'd never come up. The ocean whiskey, an hour a diving duck. You know, I swim to the bottom, Lord, I'd never come up. Don't Johnny Lee. Woke up this morning, people. Look out for my shoes. Get out of my case then. Me no walking blues. Woke up this morning. Look out for my shoes. You know I gotta have my case then. Me no walking blues. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And now the weekly review of the news with Disrespect. These are not the full articles that we read to you. For the full articles, go to the newspaper and the writers that we identify in the newscast. Hamilton Spectator, Monday, November 16th. Odd, these two stories should be side by side. Liberals introducing HST bill. Stress disorder overdiagnosed, study shows. A new study suggests post-traumatic stress disorder is being overdiagnosed in Canada and the Western world, a potentially costly situation that could lead to skyrocketing disability claims. It's a viewpoint that flies in the face of popular opinion as more and more soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan struggle to reintegrate. Western nations, including Canada, have proactively rejected old stereotypes in an effort to improve services for those grappling with the psychological trauma of war. But Memorial University psychiatrist Dr. Amin Mohammed warns Canada could face a huge economic burden if mental health professionals aren't more cautious about diagnosing the condition. Many cases of PTSD are not the pure cases, but just acute reactions to stress, depression, or anxiety disorders, he said. The psychiatrist began looking into the matter after more and more patients, many of them Canadian Forces veterans and immigrants from war-torn countries, started asking him to sign disability claim forms. His study is based on his own experience, those of his colleagues, and the vast amount of literature. Odd he hasn't been to Iraq or Afghanistan. Liberals introducing HST bill. Ontario's Liberal government introduced legislation on Monday to proceed with its controversial plan to harmonize the province's 8% sales tax with the 5% GST, a move the opposition parties call a blatant tax grab. The legislation will also include a package of cuts to income, small business, and corporate taxes, and provide for tax rebate checks of up to $1,000 for families to offset the HST, which will add 8% to many items currently exempt from the provincial sales tax. Says Finance Minister Dwight Duncan, right now there's a hidden tax. Businesses pay tax on tax on tax. This unbuttons that, puts the money back into their pockets. They in turn hire people and also, by the way, lower prices. Critics point out that businesses may not, in fact, pass on their tax savings by lowering prices, but the government says competition will lead to lower prices, as it has done in other places that harmonize sales taxes. Revenue Minister John Wilkinson, the government's lead salesperson on the tax changes, said the goal is to create jobs, but notes there will be help for Ontarians to cope with the impact of an 8% tax increase on such things as home heating fuel and hydro bills. Starting in January, we'll have the lowest personal income tax rate of any province, said Wilkinson. And in July, when we bring in the HST, we'll be more than doubling the permanent tax grants that are available to low-income Ontarians, seniors on a fixed income, and middle-income families with a lot of children. There will be more than $1.1 billion annually in relief and personal income tax, the lowest rate of any province. Ontario will also lower the small business tax rate and eliminate the small business tax surcharge, the only province in this country to eliminate that barrier to growth, said Wilkinson. The corporate tax rate will be cut from 14 to 12% and then 10% over 3 years, while the corporate tax rate on manufacturing, processing, and resource sectors will be cut from 12 to 10%. However, the National Citizens Coalition estimates the HST will cost the average taxpayer an additional $800 to $1,000 annually and vows to fight the move. Ontario's progressive conservatives oppose harmonization as a massive tax grab, even though it was their federal conservative cousins who convinced Ontario to sign on to the idea with the help of a $4.3 billion grant from Ottawa. Opposition leader Tim Hudak has been traveling the province, railing against what he calls the Dalton sales tax, which he warns will hit consumers hard. The New Democrats said the HST will drive up prices for consumers on a host of everyday items while giving corporations a big break. Editorial in the Hamilton Spectator, Monday, November 16th. Again, HST devils are in the details. With its decision to exempt our morning cup of coffee, snack foods under $4, and newspapers from the harmonized sales tax, the provincial government is being criticized for stooping to base populism to ease what is quickly becoming a serious political burden on the McGuinty government. Properly planned and implemented, a single tax can make doing business cheaper and less complicated for most sectors. That creates a more competitive environment, which in turn has benefits for consumers, certainly in the medium and long term. The short term is more of a question mark, which is why we have questioned from the outset the timing of HST implementation for Ontario. Given the fact there will be some economic disruption and consumers will see a difference in the price they pay for some goods and services, it's critical that the implementation phase is handled carefully and with appropriate responsiveness. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan has said there will probably be no further exemptions, but government sources say there is still some room under Ontario's agreement with Ottawa, and the province should continue its consultation and consider other strategic exemptions where they make economic sense. That said, the reality now is different than when the HST trial balloon was first floated. Ontario now faces a record deficit due to circumstances beyond its control, and the government can't afford to sacrifice too much more revenue and still keep its pledge to avoid new provincial income tax hikes. On this, the most controversial and sensitive economic issue facing Ontario, a balanced and responsive approach is the only way to move forward. One of our favorite columnists, Jim Coyle. How could Liberals let the revolt brew? The menu board behind the two cabinet ministers in Tim Hortons on Islington Avenue listed the sandwich and lunch combos. On Thursday, crow wasn't on the menu, but make no mistake, Dwight Duncan and John Wilkinson were choking it down big time. They wanted it known that the new HST the Ontario government plans to introduce next July to harmonize the federal and provincial sales taxes will not, that is not, N-O-T, not apply to your coffee and donut. In fact, Duncan's sidekicks twisted themselves into rhetorical croolers trying to identify with Tim Horton's campaign. Cabinet colleague Laurel Broughton introduced her colleagues as a ministerial double-double. Wilkinson confided that he couldn't string two words together in a coherent fashion without his morning coffee. Still a troubling question for the government remains. How could it have been so clueless as to imagine a new tax on the very definition of Canadian comfort food, sold from venues that have become the very icons of Canadian community, loyally patronized by millions of Joe and Jane Q. publics, would have done anything but invite political backlash? The very day the HST was announced in Duncan's budget last March, NDP leader Andrea Horvath must have said coffee and muffins 1,000 times if she said it once, denouncing the tax hit. It took government deep thinkers 8 months to recognize what a leader then only days on the job saw instantly, that this tax on these items was a political lightning rod. On Thursday, the McGuinty government paid a few hundred million to cut its losses. Pressure works, shrugged progressive conservative critic Peter Sherman. Apparently so. And for people who've been following Barbara Farlow and Katya Sansalone, this is interesting. Sick Kids program adds lawyers to family support teams. Paul Taylor, small doses in the Globe and Mail health section. In a unique program believed to be the first of its kind in Canada, Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children is now adding lawyers to its family support team. Some solutions need the expertise of a lawyer, said Ted McNeil, Sick Kids Director of Social Work. For instance, a family of an asthmatic child may require legal help to prod a landlord into removing mold from a building, or a parent may be unjustly fired after taking time away from work to care for an ailing child. Dr. McNeil noted a host of non-medical problems requiring expert legal knowledge to address can impede a family's ability to focus on the health of their children. But not everyone can afford a lawyer, he said. The service is really targeted at those families who face financial challenges and who might otherwise not be able to access a lawyer. I wonder. Now a break with Omar and the Howlers, Midnight Ramblin' Man.
Begin to fight. That's when I
National Post, Thursday, November 12th. Schizophrenic man allegedly beaten to death over bag of chips in Dawn Jail by Megan O'Toole in Toronto. Bad ending for good boy. Just a few short years ago, Jeff Monroe was living his dream, working as a professional dancer on a Caribbean cruise ship. On the weekend, the 32-year-old who lived and breathed dancing from the age of two was found dead in Toronto's notorious Dawn Jail, allegedly beaten to death over a bag of chips just days after landing in jail. Three prisoners, all in their early 20s, have been charged with first-degree murder in connection with his death. It's still not clear why Mr. Monroe ended up at the Dawn in the first place, let alone died there just days after walking through the prison's doors. Beaten with hands and fists, his face was smashed beyond recognition. He died at the scene. He was reportedly picked up for breaching a probation put in place after he spit at a police officer. But Detective Sergeant Wayne Banks of the Toronto Force would only confirm that Mr. Monroe was placed in the Dawn Jail after his arrest on a criminal offense. Christine Monroe says the incident raises many questions, including why her son was arrested in the first place, information police have not revealed even to her, she says. But even more troubling to her is why someone suffering from schizophrenia, like her son, was placed in the Dawn Jail among hardened criminals. I can't even describe my disappointment in the system, Ms. Monroe said yesterday from her home in Paris, Ontario. I want answers. Amid late nights and excessive partying, he was introduced to crystal meth in his 20s while working as a cruise ship dancer. Some kids struggle with things and others can deal with things, Ms. Monroe said. You're young and some people are more vulnerable than others. That's where his addiction started. It ruined his career. Mr. Monroe returned to Toronto several years ago, unable to continue dancing. He became a different man, Miss Fletcher said, one of Mr. Monroe's childhood friends. Mr. Monroe bounced from shelter to shelter as he continued to struggle with his addiction. Picked up by police for probation breaches, he was sent to the Center for Addiction and Mental Health each time instead of prison because his schizophrenia had taken hold, Ms. Monroe said. After each short stint, he would emerge with a smile on his face, seemingly stable. But as soon as he got out of there, he was right back into drugs, Ms. Monroe said. He didn't have the strength. Lawyer Barry Swadron, an expert on mental health and the legal system, said sending him to the Dawn Jail was a fatal error. For a person who's mentally ill in there, it's a nightmare. Ms. Monroe shares that nightmare. The life that Jeff led, it was always my biggest fear that something was going to happen to him, she said. But never, ever, ever would I think that my son would be murdered in jail of all places. You should be safe. And from the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, October the 28th, Neil Reynolds' column, A Prison Too Large? The Unintended Consequences of Centralization. In 2001, a Norwegian economist named Hans Melberg produced an algebraic equation to calculate with five or six known statistics the optimum degree of centralization in any government department or agency. The formula, however, didn't work out. Why? Professor Melberg determined that centralization either decreases an institution's costs and decreases the quality of its decisions, or increases an institution's costs and increases the quality of its decisions. But it's impossible in advance to know which. For Professor Melberg, one thing was clear. As information is passed upward, as in the child's game of telephone, it is seriously distorted, and in the end, quality of information simply doesn't matter. He cited a number of examples to illustrate the increasing ignorance quotients in centralized organizations. In the first example, he recalled working as a youth at summer camps in a part of Norway with many small lakes. One of his tasks was to measure water temperatures in one lake each day and to report them to the camp manager, who reported them to a regional manager, who reported them to a radio station that broadcast the readings from a number of lakes. For obvious reasons, each campground wanted to report the warmest water temperatures. This created an incentive to exaggerate. The asymmetry grows larger, Professor Melberg concluded, the further away you go from the source of the information. In the second example, Professor Melberg noted that Norway had traditionally paid compensation to people whose reindeer have been killed by eagles. Yet many people in the hinterlands falsely claimed compensation for years and routinely got government checks. A local administrator would have known that the eagles had left many years before. The distant administration in a government department centralized in Oslo wouldn't. In the third example, he cited an announcement by Norway's justice minister that the government proposed to reduce the number of police districts in the country from 19 to 5, using the usual argument that this centralization would result in more officers on the block, fewer officers doing paperwork behind their desks. But if this were so, the professor wondered, why not reduce the number of districts to 1? Obviously, a single police district would be dismissed as too much centralization, Professor Melberg reported. But on what grounds? Why is 1 district too much, 19 not enough, and 5 optimal? Obviously, again, he said, the answer must involve inexplicable trade-offs. Centralization has its good effects and bad effects. The Canadian government is considering whether to build large regional prisons for male convicts, at least, a move that recalls Professor Melberg's musings on centralization. Canada's first and only federal prison for women was built in Kingston in 1934. It was closed in ignominy a decade ago, and women now serve their sentences in comfortable institutions and healing lodges dispersed across the country. We went from maximum centralization, in other words, to maximum decentralization in a single step. Why did the correctional service decentralize for women? Why is the government now weighing centralization for men? On what gender difference does this political discrimination rest? Isn't there a constitutional challenge lurking in this dichotomy? And has anyone yet calculated which of Professor Melberg's consequences we should expect? Public Safety Minister Peter Van Loan has cited the superior security that super prisons could provide for people who work in prisons and for the public as well. Based solely on physical acts of violence inside the prisons, he might well be right, but inadvertent consequences would inevitably make the calculation difficult. Many prisoners might never see their families, who might end up living far from large regional prisons. Or such prisons might attract large numbers of family members who want to be close to incarcerated fathers and sons. These relatives, perhaps numbering in the thousands, might even want to camp conveniently close to the prisons. They would have to be regarded as prison populations too, though they would presumably live in dispirited ghetto towns outside the walls and the fences of super prisons. Bigger isn't always better, nor is super. From The Spectator, Sarah Cannon, Executive Director of Parents for Children's Mental Health. The opinions expressed here are hers alone. Youth mental illness versus H1N1. Since April, 33 deaths have been attributed to H1N1 in Ontario. Since April, death to children suffering from mental illness is double that. On average, more than 2 youths a week take their lives as a result of their mental illness symptoms not being adequately treated. As I write this, there are 82 admissions to hospitals attributable to H1N1 in Ontario. Toronto alone has more than 82 admissions in their psychiatric inpatient beds. Approximately 100 clinics have been established to address the H1N1 crisis, 50 in the last week. The average wait time for children to receive treatment for mental illness is more than 6 months. Our government is committed to setting aside $600 million to deal with the H1N1 crisis. In the last 16 years, children's mental health has received only 3 annual increase and no additional funding. The 2009 budget provided a 3% increase to health care, children's mental health nothing. More lives are lost from the symptoms of mental illness than any other physical illness, yet no additional funding and years of no investment. Lack of investment and funding is causing decreases in the already scarce services available. More lives are lost weekly because of the symptoms of mental illness than to H1N1. More admissions to hospitals have occurred in the same 6-month time frame, but still, nothing. Ask yourselves, are the lives of children and youth diagnosed with mental illness being considered a priority? The children who suffer and consequently lose the battle to symptoms have a treatable illness. Their deaths are a direct result of preventable symptoms. It's estimated that 1 in 5 children has a mental illness, yet only 1 in 6 of those children is receiving treatment. We are demanding that our governments find a way to ensure all lives are saved and protected from H1N1. Are we doing the same for the children and youth suffering from mental illness? It may be a completely different perspective and perhaps not a popular one, but I can't help but think that if we reacted with the same urgency and commitment to the crisis of mental health, perhaps my daughter would be less at risk. In Markdale, Ontario, in the Canadian Press, man shatters restaurant door over lettuce rage. Police in the central Ontario village of Markdale are looking for a man who shattered a restaurant door after becoming enraged over some lettuce and tomato on a hamburger. Police say the man stormed out of the Icy Delights restaurant during the busy lunch hour last Saturday and slammed the door so hard that it broke the glass. The man had ordered 3 burgers to go and didn't want lettuce or tomato on one, but the busy cook forgot. Police say when the man complained, the cook removed the lettuce, but that remedy didn't seem to satisfy him. He threw the burger across the restaurant and slammed the door on the way out. Bill Nethews, whose wife owns the eatery, says the man did pay for the hamburgers. Well, it's nice to know that our OPP are on top of terrorism in Ontario. In an announcement coming November the 30th, this from H Magazine. Bill Strickland, Pittsburgh native, entrepreneur, and author of Making the Impossible Possible, is coming to Hamilton this month. He'll be giving a talk through Mohawk College Enterprise entitled A Tale of Two Cities, Pittsburgh, a City Reborn, Hamilton, a City on the Rise. In reading the advertising for the event and about Strickland's life and message, I can confidently say the talk will aim to inspire those in attendance to make positive possibilities for Hamilton reality. He argues that anything can happen when one's vision begins on the ground, in the very neighborhoods people live in and care about. This is November 30th, Hamilton Place Theater, 7 p.m. Tickets are free and can be picked up at Mohawk College Enterprise, 175 Longwood Road South, located on the first floor at the McMaster Innovation Park. And that's the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. You can be sure there will be more. Now to go out, Jimmy Thackeray and the Drivers, Drive to Survive.
I'm sorry. sun's free. I don't spend all night worrying about me. I'll be gone like a cold, cool breeze. I wanna hear you begging, please, please, please. I'll drive to survive. Yes, I will. I'll drive. You know I'll drive to survive. Hey, hey.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.